Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 320 for Tuesday, November 7th, 2017. On the show today, Facebook, Twitter, and the Russians. Sean Gallagher, the Baltimore-based editor of Ars Technica, helps us understand just what Russian operatives and their bots did on the world's biggest social media platforms in an attempt to influence the U.S. election 1 year ago. Sean will be joining us in a few minutes. Up front, a conversation with my colleague from the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, criminal justice reporter Justin Fenton, about his look at Baltimore's Let's Make a Deal Court. I use that term for the court where Judge Charles J. Peters presides because 93% of felony convictions in Baltimore are the result of plea deals, and some three-quarters of them are taken in front of Judge Peters. That's what Justin found. Justin, nice to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And you found this after spending a considerable amount of time looking at proceedings of what's known as the reception court in Baltimore. Am I right? 250 cases or so? You listen to recordings of the proceedings?
Yeah, it started out, there's a lot of talk over the summer about judges and sentencing. Obviously, Baltimore is in the third year of a violent crime spike, and there's been some pressure on judges and sentencing. So we wanted to try to take a look at how exactly are the sentences reached? Are the judges, what role do the judges play in that? And it seemed to me that the best place to look was this reception court. For people who don't know, the court is set up with this one judge, and every case comes before him, basically. After you're arraigned, you come to his courtroom, and this is done in an effort to free up other judges for trial. So he basically handles everything. He says, you know, are you ready to take a plea? Do you need a postponement? Is the state going to drop the case? And he tries to sort it all out.
It's like triage.
Yeah, and everybody who wants to go to trial, he'll then shoot those out to the other 14 judges. But if you're ready to work it out, you work it out in front of Judge Peters.
So the judge will sit there, and the state will propose a deal on a criminal charge?
So the prosecutors and the defense will try to work out an agreement behind the scenes. And if they can reach one, they just simply come up to the judge and say, we've reached a deal. And he'll say, sounds good, and that's that. Oftentimes, though, they come up to the bench, and the state is offering something, and the defense is not willing to take it. And the judge sort of inserts himself into that process, and he can undercut the deal. Sometimes he increases it. He doesn't think it's good enough. And so what we wanted to do was get more insight into that process, because we've heard the state complain about that. They've said that, you know, the judges undercut them and that they shouldn't do that. We wanted to see just how often that happened. And one of the big takeaways was that these sentences that have been so heavily criticized, the state often approaches the judge with a sentence that many may perceive to be light, that brings suspended time. There's lots of reasons for that, but a lot of times he's either accepting an offer that the state wanted to begin with, or he's reducing something that was already significantly reduced to begin with.
Okay, meaning in the... maybe the term that the police commissioner of Baltimore would use is too light a sentence going into it.
Right.
Because he's been one of the critics,
right.
Police Commissioner Davis.
He assembled data for gun arrests that showed that, I think, 60% of the time that was imposed was suspended. And again, for people who don't speak this language, you can get a sentence of 5 years, let's say, and the court can suspend a significant portion of that time. And you can be put on probation, and if you violate your probation, that time is hanging over your head. So, for example, a five-year sentence with all but two years suspended, you serve 2 years, and you have the threat of three more hanging over you.
If you violate your probation.
Correct. And this is a way they try to not send people away for 5 years. They try to give them a chance, try to get them on their feet, comply with the terms of their probation, but there is something there if they are not able or willing to do that. But what we found was that a lot of times the state enters that negotiation already offering the suspended time that people are criticizing the judges for giving.
You had some percentages, if you don't mind. I'm not sure if you know these off the top of your head. I saw them in your tweet again today.
As you said earlier, 93% of cases end in plea deals. That leaves 7% of cases that are going to trial. What that tweet referred to was this was I was looking at that subset of cases, and the point I was trying to make was that even when people elect to go to trial, they often still take a plea, or the case is dropped.
Oh, I see it. Okay, let me give that to our listeners here in case you didn't see Justin's tweet. It was 1,033 people who elected to go to trial. This is in 2016. 40% of them ended up taking a plea deal in front of a trial judge, not Judge Peters, but the trial judge. 14% of the cases sent to trial were dropped. 17% of people went to trial and were convicted. 23% went to trial and were acquitted. And then there was another 8% that ended in mistrial.
Yeah, and those are percentages. The actual number of people who went to trial and were convicted last year in Baltimore City was 175 people. I find that shocking.
When you consider how many cases there are.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily surprising. I think in the federal system, there's 95 or 96% of the cases are pleaded out. But the idea that only 175 people had a trial and were convicted is just, it's a very small number when you consider all the different cases that are coming in front of the court. And there was a professor I spoke to who calls this the dirty underbelly of the criminal justice system. Mm. But he said it also works for everybody. It works for everybody. It works for the prosecutors who don't want to take the case to trial, who don't want to risk losing.
And why is that? So I wanted to examine that with you a little bit.
Yeah, I mean,
why don't they want to go to trial? Because this gets to what I think is a very serious problem in our system, in our culture here.
Yeah, and that is a portion of the article that I touch on because we've written a lot about it in other venues, but a lot of these cases are not strong. The police do take hundreds of guns off the street each year, but I don't think people realize that a lot of times they're making a traffic stop and they're searching the car and finding the gun in the wheel well or in the trunk or under a seat, and they're charging all four people in the car with having a gun found under one person's seat because no one will take ownership of it. So on paper, you see three people who probably get acquitted there. The case is dropped, and people throw up their hands and say, man, nobody gets in trouble for having guns in this city. But, they don't know that these are cases where a gun is found in a shoebox in a closet or in the car, as I said. So, I mean, the prosecutors suspect people are involved in criminal activity. They don't want to just let them go. And so they ride it out until the point where it comes before the judge. They offer a deal. The defendant, is taking a roll of the dice. I think most people realize that if they go to trial and they are convicted, they could face much more serious time. So a lot of times you see people getting out on time served. In the city, they wait 10 to 15 months just awaiting a trial if they can't make bail or don't get a bail. And so they've already served a year and a half, a year, 6 months, and a lot of times that's the end of it. But they got a conviction on their record.
So there's a concern on the state's part about the integrity of the arrest. There's probably still a concern about juries and whether they believe cops in Baltimore.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there was one attorney I spoke to who said that there's a perception that at a trial you're going to have a 50-50 chance of beating the case. The stats bore that out. The stats from the judiciary show that I think it's actually a 57% chance that the defendant is going to prevail in trial. So, I mean, I think the prosecutors are trying to offer something that the defendant will take so they can get the conviction, so that they can have the stats. But there's a lot more behind the suspended time.
Justin, how do the claims of Police Commissioner Davis stand up based on what he said about gun cases specifically that end with suspended sentences?
I mean, the stats are they bear out. I mean,
they're accurate.
That was a heavily researched thing where they actually showed us the raw data.
Mm-hmm.
They had all the cases that they compiled, we looked at that last year in a big story. They're cases with problems, but as people try to figure out how to get this crime spike under control and they see people getting short sentences for guns, I think everybody's trying to figure out how to fix that. I think it, in a lot of ways, it does start with better investigations or an understanding that not everybody deserves a 5-year mandatory minimum. These cases don't, the state has the option of they're often charging people with a count that brings a 5-year mandatory minimum or a 15-year mandatory minimum. They look at it and realize this guy isn't going to take that. He's not going to plead guilty to that. He's going to take it to trial. I'm probably going to lose. What can I offer him that he might take? And so they step off that charge. They decide to proceed with a misdemeanor handgun charge. So it's like, I can understand the police department is looking at these things saying, my goodness, we
made the arrest.
We got him. He's got a mandatory minimum. He's a felon in possession of a gun. Go for it. But it's not that simple.
Sentencing guidelines. This judge has sentencing guidelines. He knows what they are. You took a look at whether these cases fell within the these are state guidelines, right, for all circuit court judges. What does that look like?
Well, the city judges, surprisingly, are the second most in compliance with the sentencing guidelines. These are
all city judges.
Yes.
This is the whole circuit.
The city circuit of judges is at a rate of 86% was following the sentencing guidelines. Now, the guidelines have a wide range in some cases. They're going on the low end. But nevertheless, the stats show that they are above the state average. They're the second highest in the state behind Baltimore County and Hartford.
For meeting the sentencing guidelines.
Correct. Now, again, this is complicated,
right?
Because if the state chooses to step off a count that brings a high sentence, and they bring a very low count, and the person is sentenced within that range, you can look at that case and say that person didn't get the time that they deserved, but it was within the range. So it's one of those things where the stats show the city is sentencing appropriately based on the charges brought before them.
Can you say, based on your objective look at this, 250 cases, and I don't know how many recordings you listen to.
A lot.
A lot. Whether the state is going into these cases at a level that would satisfy the public, meaning looking for the toughest sentence they can get, or is that overly simplistic to think of it, the toughest sentence? Well, what's plausible is more like it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things there. On one hand, I was very surprised. In none of the cases I listened to did the state really advocate for their position. So I'll give you an example. They would say that, so-and-so deserves 8 years. We're offering 8 years. And the judge might say, well, I'm going to give him, 5 years. The state never came back. And the defense would stand there and say, my guy's going to school. He's completing his program. He's got a kid.
He's paying child custody.
It's been 10 years since his last conviction. They'd stand up there and give a two-minute, thing about why he shouldn't get the time the state was asking for. Mm-hmm. I never once heard the state advocate for the time that they wanted.
In 250 cases?
Yeah. Well, I mean, 50 of them resulted in actual plea deals, and some of them were plea negotiations that weren't fruitful that day. But I never really saw the state really advocating for what they wanted, and there was a few times where they even said, I'm asking for 3 years, but I'll stay silent on probation before judgment. And what people told me was that that's a way that that the prosecutors sort of say, I'm okay if you do that, but I'm not really going to actually advocate for it.
Yeah.
But then there's a flip side of this where there was an appellate court decision last year that I think the legal community here is still trying to grapple with what exactly it means. And the Court of Appeals said pretty much explicitly that judges shouldn't get involved, that they should not undercut the state's offer. People told me this is a city phenomenon. It doesn't really happen in other jurisdictions. And the state's attorney's office told me, we don't like that. I was able to get a rare interview with Judge Pearson, who was the administrative court judge, and Judge Peters himself.
They said that the judge should not make deals.
They said
it's up to the state to make the deal.
They said a trial court judge should not intervene. The main reason was that there were some cases. I think the case in question that the appellate court reviewed was one where somebody was offered like a 10-year deal from a judge pre-trial. And then the case went to trial in front of that judge. Guy got convicted and he got 20. And they said, well, if you offered me 10 earlier, it's still the same crime. I'm still the same guy. Are you punishing me?
Am I being penalized for going to trial?
And are you coercing people to take pleas because they are going to get more time after trial? Now, there's a tricky thing here where Judge Peters is not a trial judge. As I said earlier, he's not the one trying cases. He sends them out to trial judges. And so they feel as though, he's okay to be getting involved. But the state's attorney's office doesn't like it. And I'm not really sure what kind of recourse they have, but it's an interesting question about whether they should be fighting harder, whether they should be citing that appellate court decision, or whether they're okay with this, because again, it works for everybody.
Right. There were cases where the judge increased the sentence above what was recommended by the state?
There was a couple. I think there was maybe two or three where he wanted more time. I think there was a case where somebody had an assault weapon in a trunk, and the state was offering a suspended sentence, and Judge Peters said, and oozing the trunk, 6 months. And I thought that was interesting because, the defense had walked up, they could have taken the state's deal, but they wanted even less, and they ended up, coming away with more. He has a lot of power there.
One last thing. There's still part of this that isn't open to the public, right? I mean, you actually got into what's known as the white noise when you're in the courtroom and they play that sound so you can't hear what's being discussed in a bench conference. That's what you listen to.
Correct. If you were to go into the reception court and sit there, you would hear very little.
Okay.
You would sort of see the finished plea deals, you might hear what was offered and what the judge isn't giving instead. But this was an effort to get behind into the sausage making process.
Right. But and up until you did this, the state would not show you its proposals?
The state does not put the proposals into the court file and says that they do not keep track of how often they are undercut. That is surprising to me, considering how much not just this administration but past administrations has complained about this issue. And again, when you actually listen to the tapes, a lot of times they were walking up there with an offer and not really advocating for it, or in fact sort of winking and nudging that they would even take less. So, you know, even if they were keeping track of it, these conversations reveal what they in practice are actually asking for.
Justin Fenton, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Justin Fenton covers courts, cops, and criminal justice for the Baltimore Sun. Now, you can find a link to his story on plea deals in Baltimore in the notes for this podcast, or go to baltimoresun.com. A quick word from our sponsor, then Sean Gallagher joins us to talk about Twitter, Facebook, and the Russians.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes best-selling author and former science reporter Dava Sobel. In her new book, The Glass Universe, Sobel presents the story of women's landmark contributions to astronomy. Friday, November 10th at 7 p.m. More at the Ivy Bookshop or call 410-377-2966.
Sean Gallagher, the Baltimore-based editor for Ars Technica, the tech news website, is with us again, this time to explain what's up with Twitter, Facebook, and the Russians, and how two of the world's largest social media platforms ended up as players in the 2016 presidential election. Let me see if I have this right, okay?
Okay, go ahead.
Congress is, you know, working on Facebook and Twitter to see if they understand that they were accomplices to Donald Trump's election last fall.
That's one interpretation.
Yeah.
So the problem is that Facebook and Twitter have not been regulated in terms of political advertising. When you do political advertising as an election campaign or as a PAC or something like that, you generally have to file paperwork saying we're doing this advertising and declare it to the public. Right. And
who's behind this ad?
Right.
I paid for this ad.
Right. Exactly. That's on general media, on broadcast media, right? So
Vladimir Putin doesn't do that.
No, he does not. Nor do the various Twitter bots that are out there. So Twitter found that Russia Today, or RT, had done about $260,000 worth of sponsored tweets, which means that those were messages that were put in front of people who did not follow RT. That was just during the election. They've done something like $1.6 million worth of advertising through Twitter. And
Sputnik's another one,
and
right?
Sputnik is another one. And they didn't detail how much Sputnik had spent on that. But they have banned RT and Sputnik's accounts from buying sponsored tweets now. So that means that they can't put their message in front of people who don't follow them. However, those two media outlets are already retweeted by thousands of bot accounts. Twitter had identified something on the order of like 20,000 accounts that were spewing propaganda that was put out by RT and also other anti-anybody, sort of politically targeted messages that were being spread through various accounts.
It sounds like the messages were very divisive, too.
They were
about race and guns and not just the political campaign.
Right. And these accounts that were set up, they're set up with, usually they steal somebody's photo and they give a short fake bio and they look like they're normal human beings to the untrained observer. And they may even clone some American person's account, right? They create an account that looks just like that person. And then they post these messages that are very divisive. They go after people on both ends of the spectrum.
If I see a tweet that's very snarky, attacking libtards or something like that, right, which I often see.
Right.
It may not be a human being sitting in his basement in Tennessee. It may actually be a bot.
Yeah, no, there are people, and there are people sitting in their whatever room of their house,
right,
in various places in the country who are tweeting about libtards and things like that.
Oh yeah,
but there are also lots of bots. There are lots of these bots that take something someone else has posted and they verbatim repost it, or they add particular slogans to tweets or particular hashtags, mm-hmm. right, to make them trend, to make them show up in places where they'll become more visible to other people. On Facebook, they were doing more advertising than these sort of sponsored posts, meaning they were actually paying to promote a post or they were paying for a specific advertisement to appear within the newsfeed of people.
And that meant Facebook was approving them.
Right.
That process, for those who haven't done it, is you actually say, I want to boost this post, right?
Right. Right.
And you're willing to pay a certain amount, and you prescribe the demographic you want to appeal to, the region you want to hit, right?
Yeah, and you do that with Twitter, too. Mm-hmm. I should also add that RT has said that during the election campaign, Twitter's advertising salespeople approached them about doing an even bigger campaign. So we don't know if that's true or not. We just know that's what RT's deputy editor says. Is that they had a presentation from Twitter saying you should really buy more promoted tweets to promote your think different message during the election.
Oh sure, I imagine once you do it,
yep.
that you get more
right.
appeals to do more of them.
Right.
I have a question for you. How do you feel about the banning in this situation? On what grounds was it banned?
Well, in this case, Twitter said they banned them based on the analysis from the intelligence community that those two organizations, which are state-sponsored, they're not outright state-owned, but they're state-sponsored, were participating in an information operation. In other words, they were participating in a specific campaign coordinated by Russian intelligence to spread disinformation, misinformation, and to put a different spin on real information. And so they decided that, you know, this is propaganda sponsored by a state. We are not going to allow that. Now, that is a slippery slope in many ways. I should add that the United States has used Twitter for propaganda, and we have state-owned organizations that put things out on Twitter that could be construed as propaganda, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, things like that, the American information outlets.
Yeah, who knows what else?
And who knows what else?
I mean, do we know whether our government is creating bots?
Could say the same thing about Fox News. I mean, Fox... by sponsored tweets and things like that to get spread their message, yeah. And you know, some other country could say, "Hey, this stuff on Fox,
this is propaganda.
It's propaganda. Twitter, you should ban them from buying sponsored tweets."
What does Congress want?
First of all, they want accountability. I mean, I think part of the problem is that the ads for U.S. targeted political messages on Facebook were purchased with rubles. They were purchased with Russian currency.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that should have set off an alarm, because if you're doing political advertising in the United States, you know, maybe you should wonder whether a U.S. person is purchasing political advertising in the United States. And the thing is that Facebook and Twitter both have been very libertarian about how they do advertising. They say, we're just a platform, we're not responsible for the content. And because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and some other things, there were safe harbor provisions that basically say, if you're an information provider, you cannot be held liable for the content that gets sent over you. And so that is the whole business model for Facebook and for Twitter, is that they are not a publisher, they're not a traditional media company, they are only a channel for content, a platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore they don't take responsibility for the content that gets sent over them until they do, and they have. And so, for example, Twitter bans people for saying things that are hateful, and Facebook will ban accounts for doing things that violate terms of service. And once you get into the realm of editing the content or blocking the content of particular users, you are no longer just the internet. You are no longer just infrastructure. You are now a media company.
Do Facebook and Twitter argue that they can't be setting up a lot of filters? Is the real reason because they don't want to hire people to do that? It requires human beings and human judgment, doesn't it?
Facebook has now hired 4,000 more people to do this sort of thing.
Okay, so they've made a commitment to it.
There are ways to do artificial intelligence machine learning to sort of filter some of these things. But it does require a human being to look at it and say, confirm, that's not good. That makes no sense to me. That's something creepy, something weird. Both companies have sort of shown regret over everything happening and are trying to do things internally to fix them, mostly in hope of not being further regulated. But even one of the guys who was an early investor in Facebook has said that this industry needs to be regulated. that there has to be some control, some regulation, and some accountability for how advertising is done online. And it's a problem that expands well beyond Facebook and Twitter. In my industry, right, so in the web publishing industry, we are sort of beholden to Google. Google is responsible for DoubleClick, the advertising platform that does display advertising on websites. Also, Yahoo has an advertising engine that ties into a number of web platforms. There are all these second and third party advertising markets that are used to channel display advertising onto websites that have nothing to do with those companies. DoubleClick and Google pretty much dominate the industry. And even our own ads, they get served up through a system tied to Google, right? And this is common across the industry. So what happens when Google doesn't control the content that's coming into your site? What happens when the rules you set up for what you can display on your site get violated? Now, for example, this week, there's a mobile app called Simon the Cat, which is based on a series of videos about cartoon videos about a cat that's targeted at kids. And in the UK, it got flagged because someone complained that there was a racy advertisement that appeared in the app, which is targeted at kids over three. You're serving up an inappropriate content because you've got a third-party advertiser who's controlling what gets sent to you, and they're ignoring the rules that you set on your platform.
Well, that means there's a filter missing there.
Right. And the thing is that there's no way for you to guarantee that somebody on the back end isn't changing things to spoof around your rules to get in front of your audience. One of the biggest threats to security online is something called malvertising, which is malware within advertising. So it's got scripts in it that try to do bad things when it executes in your web browser.
Boy.
Right? So there's lots of concern about the channels that provide advertising to people through not just Facebook and Twitter, but through everything connected to the web. And Facebook and Twitter, especially Facebook, are tied to that as well. Facebook tries to do advertising tracking outside of Facebook. And you may have noticed, if you do something if you go visit a website and then you go into Facebook, you may have noticed that ads for that company that you saw on your website.
Just like any other web page, practically.
Right. Yeah. So, and it's the same thing with Google. I go visit a site that I Googled, and then I go to another website, another publication's website, and there's an ad for the company I just looked up. So, but the thing is that all of this advertising, everything that's done on the web, everything that's done in an app, is based on demographics they've collected about you, on cookies in your web browser,
sure,
on your personal profile information in Facebook.
Yeah.
It's the new normal.
Like you get used to seeing it.
So what's really concerning about the Russian stuff and with the advertising that gets placed in Facebook and Twitter that people are seeing is that it can be so very closely tailored to particular profiles of people. So, for example, there were all these ads that the Russians paid for that appeared specifically to people who had hate terms in their profiles. And Facebook was surprised by this. They didn't think that you could do that.
Let me ask you this. Given what you just said, what difference does this make? I am trying to imagine what difference this effort by the Russians made. Because were they preaching to the choir, so to speak, with their advertising? Was it going to people already predisposed to hate Hillary Clinton, for instance?
It is impossible to say what the impact was, but it may have magnified messages with people who were disgruntled one way or the other to make it more difficult to win the election or make it more divisive than it already was.
Okay.
The Trump campaign was built largely on these campaign rallies where you had a bunch of people who were very, very angry.
Lock her up.
Right.
Yeah.
And he fed that, right? And then that message got amplified by these Russian advertisements and by trolls online.
But to whom? That's my question.
People who may have been sort of on the edge of that.
Oh, okay.
Or people who may have been susceptible to that message and make them more actively promote it.
Right.
And so, when you talk to people about, the tone of politics over the last 10 years or so, people used to be afraid to talk about their political views if they were sort of on the fringe, and now they're not because they see this broadcasting of these ideas.
Yeah.
I said, if it's online, it must be true. You know, and if it's online, other people must feel the same way I do.
Or it's okay to express it.
It's okay to express it, right. Yeah. So that's what results in things like what happened in Charlottesville. And that's what happens, that's what promotes the divisiveness of things like Black Lives Matter. I mean, people get upset about it because they've been fed a message that this is really terrorism that these people are doing and things like that.
Or there can be a completely false or fake news story that's put out there that gets into the brains of people and you can't get it out once it's there, even though it's a rumor or fake, completely fake.
And the thing is, a lot of these messages are very subtle, too. So, for example, my dad retweeted some things about support our troops that were, in fact, originally launched by a UK fascist organization.
Really?
Yeah, because it was like some sort of patriotic message, but it was really a patriotic message being pushed by white supremacists in the UK.
But would you know that from looking at it?
Not until you looked at the account that it came from and followed it.
But the thing is, to your father's eye.
No, to my father's eye, it was just another patriotic thing. And then I said, hey, Dad, you know that, look at who that's. You're retweeting something that was posted by this particular party in the UK. You may want to take that out of your feed. The part of the problem is that when you do that, you're promoting people might like the page, and then more of that content shows up in their feed, and it corrupts the information they're getting in their feed.
Right.
Because the algorithms of Facebook are mysterious and strange, and you may see things that other people don't, and the reason you see things other people don't is because you liked something at some point that the machines connect to other things that you may want to see. It's like when you go to Amazon and you look at products and suggest other things you might want to buy. You get grouped in with a certain kind of person when you like something from someplace. And that magnifies the message of that particular audience to you. So Facebook is not like, you know, everything that happens in the world shows up in your newsfeed. The only things that show up in your newsfeed are things that the computer thinks you want to know. And so you may miss the message about Hillary or the message about Bernie or whatever because you've clicked on something from an organization that may have been, you know, innocent enough, but since you liked a message from them, you start to get more and more hateful or more moral divisive messages in your newsfeed.
Sean Gallagher is IT and national security editor for Ars Technica. He is based in Baltimore and joins us now and then to talk about tech news. And that's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. It's important to us. And we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.